This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Yeah, we're pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. The coronavirus is, you know, there are some certain states here that are starting to slowly get back to work, and looks like Dr. Lyle, I watched your talk with Chef AJ a couple days ago. That was really, really, really cool. Mm-hmm. Dr. Hawk, I watched your talk with Chef AJ. I think it was it today or yesterday?
It was today. Clearly, you have too much time on your hands.
Well, as I said in the last podcast, I've been doing a little more organizing, mm-hmm. and there's one thing that I can do while I'm organizing. That's listen to Dr. Hawk speak on different topics, Dr. Delisle talk on different topics. But one thing that was really interesting is I found a magazine from 2016. It was Time Magazine, and on the front cover was a mosquito, and the cover, let me pull it up right now.
Oh my God. Is that the infamous virus cover?
Yes,
it was the Zika virus,
a mysterious illness with devastating effects, is the next public health crisis in our backyard. Mm-hmm. And 4 years later, who would have thought?
Mm-hmm. But some psychic predicted this.
I'm sure my psychic knew.
Oh my goodness.
Well, listeners have accused Dr. Lyle of having a crystal ball, and soon they will do the same thing with Dr. Hawk. So, you know, we'll look.
Except I actually do have a crystal ball.
Oh my!
All right. Well, there have been some comments about coronavirus stats. So we'll, you know, I know Dr. Lyle, you said that you know, as the more data comes out, we'll know more. And mm-hmm. so everybody who has emailed me just asking you, Dr. Lyle, to clarify certain little tiny statistics, just keep in mind I have received those messages, and we can, you know, I'll consolidate them once we know more, and then we can kind of go over it all at once. So
sure.
But until then, we've got some questions about how to deal with certain things going on as a result of this pandemic and certain lockdown situations and stay-at-home warnings, etc. So let's just get started. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, you guys ready?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Dear Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, help! Am I going to lose friends over this virus? Most of my friends are overwhelmed with fear and are just bossing everyone around. Seems like if I don't agree with their demands, i.e. wear a mask, even when outside and 6 feet apart, or in my car, or if I don't show as much fear as they do, I get the strong impression that it could have a negative impact and permanent impact on the friendship. I've had to lie to my close friends, and I don't like being put in that position. I honestly am starting to feel a bit harassed. How can I manage this?
Well, I don't have any friends, Jen, so...
Yeah,
that's you should take that.
So, yeah, that's Doug's favorite answer when he wants to get out of answering some kind of social question or some question about social processes, and I happen to know that it's not at all true. But, yeah, I can go ahead and answer this. I talked a bit about this on the aforementioned show with AJ, so if people want to go back and watch that, we talk about this in great detail. There's a lot of different components here. I also wrote about this in the essay that we've talked about, which is on my website and my newsletter called Of Personalities in Pandemics, because what we're looking at is a crisis situation that is bringing out personality differences into, it's really just putting them in very sharp relief. And so if there are pre-existing cleavages in your friendships, it's going to become increasingly apparent when you put them under stress, just like it's going to happen with any relationship. And part of what's going on is that because people are really afraid and in a situation of great uncertainty and a bad information, that people are not necessarily reacting in a way that we would call rational. It is rational. They're running rational estimates of their likelihood of genetic survival and reproduction, but they're behaving in very different ways as a result of their underlying personality dynamics. So if you are, for example, a very agreeable introvert, you're going to respond very differently to requirements to wear a mask in public and to practice social distancing than your disagreeable introvert friends are. They're going to be really very happy to wear a mask and socially distance and stay at home. It's going to kind of hit all of their circuits of their preferences, their underlying preferences for what they want the world to look like anyway, where it's going to come really sharply into contrast with yours. So this is why no one situation, no one crisis, no one traumatic experience is going to affect everyone in the population the same way. It's all the way that different environmental circumstances interact with personality. So I totally get where they're coming from, where the questioner is coming from, where it feels like people are being unreasonably afraid, making unreasonable demands, and that you kind of have to misrepresent yourself or, as the questioner says, lie to your friends, and you don't like doing that. I would say you got to run the cost-benefit analysis more broadly on the friendship and, you know, how valuable overall is the friendship to you. We've talked about friendship on the show before, where friends are essentially Stone Age insurance policies. You invest in friendships. You pay the premium to a friendship by investing the time and energy in caring about that person and being part of their emotional landscape so that they're there for you when things go badly. So if that person is in your life and is an overall good value proposition and you just have some conflict over how to handle this situation, then it might be worth just kind of riding it out and waiting for things to get back to something approaching normalcy, which hopefully we are getting to by midsummer, the end of summer anyway. I'll let Doug talk about the latest numbers on that if he wants to get there. But, you know, there's also a very likely chance that this is the kind of moment where you realize who you're really dealing with in a friendship, and that the fact that this person is not an insurance policy that you want to continue investing in, that they're not going to be there for you in a crisis in the way that you imagine that they would be. You're essentially getting a preview of how that insurance policy pays off when you need it, and maybe the cost-benefit analysis has changed because you're starting to see who this person really is. And it's no longer a relationship that is going to really work for you. So those are all the moving parts to kind of keep in mind. But the main thing that is going on is that people are just becoming more of who they already were when they're under pressure. And that's always going to happen in this kind of situation.
Yeah, right on target. Yeah, I actually think about this. We have a mutual friend, Jen, that's just OCD. And so I deal with essentially something similar to this all the time, going into his house, having to wash your hands, wipe your feet, get cross-examined about whether or not you stepped in any bird poop, you know, anything under the sun. And this is just part of the price to deal with someone who has a personality that is, you know, got a screw loose. And so, and that's, so what you say is perfect sort of cinemascope of the issue. The overall CB is fine. That doesn't mean that there aren't costs that are a pain in the ass.
Well, and that mutual friend is a very high value friend. Like he really is there for you in a pinch, other than this insane
right.
behavior that he displays over his OCD like
right.
tendencies.
He's actually quite happy right now.
Yeah, so I bet he is.
The whole world has come around to seeing things properly.
Yeah.
Everybody, he had plenty of that hand sanitizer stored in his bathroom. It was always in there for the last 30 years. So, yeah. So this is what this is, and again, two ways to go. Either, you know, we ride it out, knowing that this is a short term. You know, this is a matter of weeks now that we're gonna have to deal with this, or it's obnoxious enough and annoying enough, and we discover that they don't really feel that valuable to us, that this becomes a periscope to look through and reanalyze the CB. one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the other day I waited as long as I could to go to Costco to get some supplies here at the Fasting Escape, and I finally went. And I was just curious because face masks are required before you go in. And when I was at the checkout stand paying the bill, they require a Costco membership card. And I wanted to ask him, like, how do you know it's me when I have a mask on my face and I have to show you my picture ID?
Yeah, that's actually, for people who claim that this is all a giant conspiracy, deep state, you know, Bill Gates, vaccine conspiracy, blah, 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 insert your conspiracy theory of choice here. The one thing that really convinces me that it's not is that it's completely at odds with the deep state, security state, facial ID technology. So we wouldn't have invested for so long in the ability to track people everywhere that they go with facial technology, ID technology, to just block it with masks. So that comforts me.
You know, I've got a personality that's just rife for this whole, you know, scared or nervous about the, you know, government intrusion and whatnot. So, but thank God for the statistics and Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk's analysis, because that has really helped stem that tide.
Yeah, don't do anything rash. Call us first. All right.
All right. Well, our next question. Dear doctors, my issue is on conflict. In my situation, I always want to run away from conflict and get away as fast as I can. I'd like to know how I can stop feeling this way and just deal with the conflict without going into a downward spiral. Anytime a conflict arises at work with a customer, that's part of my job to help solve the problem and make them feel better and reassure them. But I always feel attacked and it sends me into a spiral. I feel like I can't listen to anything they're saying and I can't get past their anger. I know I'll be put into a cycle of running from conflict instead of just dealing with it. So how can I prevent myself from feeling like it's the end of the world and actually getting so upset that I'm shaking, nauseous, and lightheaded? I'd really love to be able to beat my genes.
Yeah, interesting problem. And so I would say a few things about this. One of the things that I would say would be that if you have a recurrent situation in your workplace where you have to do something like this and you are not personality-wise well-suited to it, you have really two options. And number one is you get out of that situation by, you know, not everybody is in a situation where they have to deal with customers and they have to actually manage customers' anger. So this individual is not an individual that's genetically well-suited to customer service. So fortunately, not that many people in the world have to do customer service. So if you're doing customer service and you're not well-suited to it, then you should be trying to figure out how you're going to angle your way out of there. Go be a librarian. You know, do something else. Mow lawns. I don't care what it is. Be an IT person that isn't on the other end of the phone. Now, let's suppose that that's a very good job and you've got a lot of skill and there's substantial income involved and this just happens to be something that goes with the territory and there's no way out of it. At that point, there's a set of skills that can make you far more effective at dealing with other people's anger. None of this will come naturally because we can see that your personality is that this is overwhelming this personality. This personality is very sensitive to other people's anger and therefore highly reactive, etc. So this is not a good personality match at all. My friend Alan, this isn't a problem. this isn't even remotely a problem. There could be an entire gang screaming red in the face, you know, with literally weapons drawn, and his heartbeat would go from 47 beats a minute to 47 and a half.
It's funny
because
it's true.
That's how it is. It's been seriously questioned whether or not he's actually really alive. So this individual clearly has a highly responsive nervous system that doesn't look anything like this. Now, what can you do? Well, there are techniques there are essentially methods for dealing with interactions with other people when you're in conflict, that if you learn those techniques, they can make you more effective. And so essentially, this has been shown in movies before, I think. I don't know. I'd have to think of one. Coming to a sports analogy again, Jen.
Oh, no. God, restrain yourself.
Sorry about that. Actually, I think I read this story about the super fine quarterback Andrew Luck in his rookie year in training camp. He was doing a brilliant job of attacking the secondary, and the coaches on the defense said, okay, well, it's time to show him a blitz. And he had, you know, he thought he knew how to read a blitz because he was a, you know, all-star college quarterback. But it turns out, no, he didn't know anything about reading a professional blitz. And within 5 minutes, the kid was, like, demoralized. He's been hammered by a professional defense. And he then went to the tapes, and they said, okay, now you know what it's like to actually get a professional blitz. And he went to the tape room, and they went over it and over it and over it and showed him the details of the interactions so that by the end of a few hours, he's like, okay, I see the patterns now. Now I understand what I'm dealing with. And he began to learn how to be a pro quarterback. So in the same way, customers that come at you and they're angry, there's a pattern, okay? It's a blitz. And if you don't know how to handle a blitz, it doesn't matter how smart you are and what a fine human being you are, et cetera. You could be Andrew Luck. But the truth is, if you don't know how to handle it, you're in trouble. And so there's ways to do it. And so I could just give you a few things. Some of the beautiful words that you can give to people is you can say, you're right. Okay? I understand. I hear what you're saying, and you're right. You know, you totally have a point. I just understand what's going on. And so it doesn't matter. When they hear those words, those are like magic words. And so they start to settle down. You start to break they're sort of in a panic that they're not going to get what they want. And they're very angry, and they feel incredibly righteous. But if they hear that there's something about what they're saying, that you're saying that they're right, it calms them down tremendously. Okay? So as you're listening to them, they will say something that's right. Okay, they're not going to say everything that is a distortion that's wrong. So you listen for that, and behind that you say, you're right. You've totally got a point. Let's see what I can do to help you. Okay? Boom. We take the wind out of the sails, out of the anger as fast as we can. Okay? So these are some of the techniques that we need to acquire to learn how to run blitzes, to deal with blitzes. Once you understand what you're doing, right now this person is probably just thinking on their feet. They're using their instincts. And their instincts are, as a sensitive, decent person, when they're putting up with anger, it's too much for them. And so these are situations that they want to avoid because they cause tremendous adrenaline rushes and confusion about how it is to manage it. Instead, if you are going to get stuck in this job, and this is actually something that you're going to need to learn how to do, we cannot change your personality and turn you into Alan Goldhammer. We just can't. It's not possible. But what we can do is we can turn you into a quarterback that learns how to read a blitz. And we can get you, and you can, once you understand what it is that you're going to do, you're going to want to do those things. And now the next time you see it coming, you'll actually be a little bit excited about watching it coming. It's like, here it comes, and now I'm going to do this in order to defuse it. Okay? Flattery, reassurance, explanation that, of course, they've got a point, and yes, something definitely needs to be done. Okay? I will do everything I can to help you. Okay? In other words, what you're having is you're starting to make sure that they understand it's not them against you. It's you and them against the problem, okay? And that problem may be your company and your company's policy. So it's like, oh, God, the people in accounting, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do about this, but let me see if I can help you, okay? It's us against them. So when you start to use these kinds of techniques, these are ways that we can diffuse that anger. And once you see that the anger is diffused very consistently in people when you use these kinds of ideas, then it turns out that this won't be so upsetting. You'll be somebody that knows how to read a blitz. Okay. In fact, it won't even be that difficult. So that's the we can't change you. You're going to have some adrenaline and some degree of stress over these things because it doesn't fit your personality. But if we can't get around it, what we can do is we can get you very, very good at managing this specific challenge with essentially by learning and understanding how the human being works on the other side. The human being on the other side that's upset most fundamentally feels like they've been treated unfairly. It is the inference of unfairness that drives the emotion of anger. Anger is, in fact, the emotion that is a signal to the nervous system that it's been treated unfairly. What it is then doing is it's actually threatening. Anger is a threatening constellation. The human being gets bigger, it sits up, it expands itself, it looks larger. These are all, it raises its voice. Everything about it is part of an animalistic violence threat. And of course, if you're on the other side of this and you don't have any axe to grind, all you are is standing in the way of someone who is very upset. This can be very intimidating, unless you're Alan, at which point you're not intimidated at all. Okay? And so so what we want to do is we want to essentially develop a psychological judo where we understand that we're not going to use force with force. That's going to do nothing other than escalate the situation. We're essentially going to turn their own momentum and just guide them exactly where it is that we want to put them, which is to have them understand, listen, I'm with you. That doesn't sound fair to me at all. Let me look into this. You've got a point. You're right about that. Let me see what can be done. Okay? If you essentially flood them with data that says, I hear you, and it sounds to me like you've been treated, you know, like things are not right, something needs to be done. If we do this, then this is how it is that we're going to diffuse situations like this. So obviously, there may be other trainings that you have. There may be limitations about what it is that you can say. But what we do need to do is to be triangulating on how it is to diffuse the most fundamental mechanism, which is the latent aggression and anger that is trying to threaten you because they feel like they've been treated unfairly. Okay? So one of the words that I use is not only you're right, but also, I need to be fair. I want to be completely fair. That may or may not be appropriate in this person's particular professional situation, but other situations where come up in my professional life where people are upset and I've had to say, listen, I need to be totally fair and I intend to be completely fair with you, okay? That relaxes them on the other side because it's not an us versus them comment. It's actually a collaborative kind of a signal. So anyway, this is how we do it. This is how to handle a blitz in any form, and we do so by preparation, repetition, and understanding of the dynamics. If we do that, then you can survive it.
That's wonderful, and I'm sure over currently with this, pandemic situation, I talked to a cashier at the local grocery store, and they were expressing to me how many frustrated customers are coming in just because of the new situations going on in stores, and it's just a little bit of a stressor. So the most disagreeable people will lash out, and so hopefully this will help a lot of these people in these customer service situations.
Yeah, I will just add to it that there are particular challenges for the agreeable nervous system here, which this person almost certainly is. So this question is very reminiscent of, Doug has heard some of my stories of my days working at Starbucks, which was not that long ago, a couple of years ago. And the way that this questioner describes getting into this sort of escalated spiral, this sort of like you can't even quite, it's all you hear is static in your head. You can't kind of deal in the moment because you're feeling this overwhelming anxiety and fear with the situation. I think I wound up putting some of what he's talking about into practice just sort of accidentally, not realizing the theory behind it. But I would do it in a very sort of passive-aggressive way, and I would feel myself sort of seething with anger as like, oh, I'm so sorry. I guess I should really look into that for you. You're absolutely right. And inwardly, I was just like, you every sort of bad word that you could imagine, and I would get really, really escalated about it. And this kind of thing had really strong physical tells. Like, I would get very adrenalized. My heart would be really racing. I would feel really sort of have this almost out-of-body experience with it. So that would be the first cue that you're not triggered. You're not hashtag triggered from some psychodynamic childhood fear, which is what I thought at the time was going on. I'm like, oh, I'm being reminded of my abandonment issues because this customer is being mean to me. No, that's not what's going on. What is going on, particularly for an agreeable person, is that this is a battle for who's the bigger victim. So the person on the other end of the register is saying that they've been treated unfairly and that they're a victim. And you know that that's not true because you weren't able to do what needed to be done because you're not empowered by corporate and you can't do what you need to do. And if they understood that, they wouldn't be coming after you like this. So if you put exactly what Doug is talking about into practice and you turn it against them, the first thing you have to do is kind of tune in, like, oh, I'm feeling this physical tell that I'm all escalated and triggered by this. So I'm essentially perceiving that I'm being victimized in this situation. Is that actually true? Am I really being victimized? And just kind of check yourself before you wreck yourself, and take that moment before you just lash back out at them. And then you can turn the energy around more authentically on them instead of it being this, you know, nasty, passive-aggressive mess.
Another little aspect of this that I didn't mention is that whenever possible, you want to blame somebody else for this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is blame Common Big enemy. Louie all the way, okay? So this is, you know, if you're in, I don't know, if you're in production, you blame accounting. If you're in accounting, you blame production. If you're in either, if you're not in either one of those, you blame management. Whatever. You find, whatever the recurrent conflicts are.
If you're self-employed, you blame the lawyers, right?
Yeah, always blame the lawyers.
Always blame the lawyers, that's right. And so this is, you know, finding out who it is that you're going to blame allows you to quickly agree and appease, and yet you don't necessarily have to give ground because the line that goes with Big Louie is, gee, I wish I could, but I can't. It's totally fair. You completely have a point. I understand what you're saying, and I wish I could do something about it, but I can't do it. Okay? That takes the edge off of their anger. They understand they've been heard, and that they understand that they're seen as a victim, and that it's and that you see the fairness. But there's nothing you can do about it. I wish so much I could. I just can't. I'm not allowed to. It's just not it, etc. These are this is what I would tell guys, by the way, in prison. So I would have guys that would come to me and that they were in a serious bind, that the prison gang was telling them they had to put a knife in somebody. And they didn't know what they were going to do. Like, they were in a serious bind about, you know, they didn't want to commit another crime or be involved in it. They didn't want to be in the gang, etc. But at the same time, they're under tremendous pressure. They're under a lot of threat. And so what we would try to do is exactly this. I mean, this is where blaming Big Louie was literally born in my repertoire, was how is it that we're going to take the edge off of the other person's anger? And the way we're going to take the edge off, believe me, it isn't that we are going to make the gangs okay with it. They're not going to be okay with it. They just need to be 10% less angry than they are. If they are 100% angry and we get defiant or tell them to get lost or whatever it is, that's very dangerous. But if we have some possible Big Louie that we can blame, that's what we do. And so very often we might have used religion. So we might have used, I made a promise to God that I would never do this, or be there to their mother, okay? So their mother and God were my two favorite.
Can't argue with it.
Big Louie's with my guys in the prison, okay? Yeah. And so this is a way for them to say, you know, I really wish I could, but I swore to my mother that I would just not do something like this. And they'd be like, well, they'll threaten the daylights out of you. They're threatening the daylights out of you. They're snarling at you. They're swearing to you that you spent your last week on earth, okay? But the bottom line is, you say, hey, if it is, it is. You know, I hear you. You're right. You know, this is... Yeah, you guys are in charge. I know that this is something I'm supposed to do, but I really wish I could, but I can't. I just can't do it. When they see that, they realize, wow, there's some internal moral high ground that the guy is not arguing with me about what's right. It's just that they can't. So this is a super important distinction about what's fair, okay? I'm saying it's totally fair. You're right. You know what I'm saying? You gave me a new pair of shoes last year and said it wasn't going to cost me anything, and now I'm supposed to bump somebody off on the prison yard that you guys don't like, okay? And so I understand that it's totally fair, and I should do this for you, and I wish that I could do it for you, and I want to do it for you, but I can't do it for you because I swore to my mother that I wouldn't, okay? This is the very, very thin veil of insulation that a guy might have. It might be the difference between him surviving or getting dragged into a mess that he's never going to get out of. And so this is the same kind of a thing that we use in conflict situations like this. We find a big Louie. We find an excuse. We agree with them all the way down the line. We understand. We agree. We understand. They deserve. They've got a point. They're right, etc. I wish I could, but I can't. Okay? So even a steamrolling, you know, completely out of control nut job, we keep feeding to them that they're right, that they've got a point. We see it their way. We wish we could, but we can't. If we do that, they will calm down. So hopefully this is a little set of instructions on for this individual and anybody else about how you give anybody bad news about anything. Whenever you give people bad news, like the dogs, we tell them we wish you could but you can't, and that's the best. You know, that's the. It may not be totally satisfying. It's not like they're going to be fine and shrug their shoulders and say okay. But the issue is it's going to take an edge off of their anger. And that's the biggest thing that we need to see.
Yeah, and then they take it to your manager who submarines you.
Yeah, that's right. That's fine. That's fine.
That's fine. That's what the manager's for.
Sure.
Totally.
Exactly.
But that is also something that in your position with your personality, you need to like train in not taking personally. Like that's the chain of command. That's how it's supposed to go. Disagreeables are going to escalate to that point where you don't be too attached to your particular outcome with that customer. You're just a cog in the greater complaint machine.
Now, Dr. Lau, would you say that, and Dr. Hawk, would you say that every time the person escalates and they say, I want to talk to the next supervisor, is that one standard deviation of disagreeable?
Yeah,
that's probably a good metric. Yeah.
It's very, very good. Yeah. It's a right on target, Nathan. Yeah.
All right, our next question. Does the fear that has gripped the U.S. qualify as clinical mass hysteria? Or, since it has been driven by poor health statistics and media reporting, is it justifiable? We might get a little hot water because of that.
Well, I don't know if it's justifiable. It certainly is. It's explainable. Like it makes sense that this is happening. I don't know if there's such a. I don't think there's such a thing as clinical mass hysteria. Are you as an actual psychologist? I just play one on TV, Doug.
No.
Is that a thing? Oh, yeah,
no.
Yeah. I don't think that's. There's certainly. Activity that resembles something that we would call mass hysteria happening in sort of a political sense. Like, I think that's a fair accusation, and it's absolutely being driven by an informational free-for-all. So, and people, you know, who have listened to me rant about this in various forms know that I blame social media for a lot of this. Sort of the fact that we live in this post-facts, post-authority, post-credentials kind of world where everybody with a Twitter account gets to be an expert. And so there's a lot of there's just a lot of different interpretations of reality. A lot of them are being delivered with great authority and conviction, and people are very confused about who to believe. And again, we're seeing it filtered through personality, where people who are more prone to believe conspiracy theories are going to attach themselves to experts that are proposing conspiracy theories to explain things, and people who are more prone to being fearful and stressed out and convinced that everybody needs to stay at home until we have an absolute zero death count, they're going to be attached to confirmation bias in that direction. So I think the first thing is with that question is to, again, just kind of interrogate whether it's accurate or not. I don't think there is a a wholesale fear gripping the United States. I think there's a lot of fear gripping a lot of people who are sort of predisposed to being fearful. But I think there are a lot of people who are not very fearful at all. The people who are storming the state house in Michigan are not very fearful. The people who are the disagreeable extroverts that are sort of driving that campaign and who are have had enough already and are hashtag open America, those are not people who are gripped by fear. So you're watching some part of the bell curve that is, and they are having that psychological experience in some part because of the information that they've exposed themselves to. But it's a combination of the information that they're exposed to along with the predispositions in their personalities. So I don't think, particularly now that this whole thing has mapped so perfectly onto this pitched partisan battle that we're going to be watching unfold for the rest of the election season, we're not going to get to some kind of consensus about what the truth is. There it's just not going to happen. There's too much competition in the informational space, and there's too many incentives for the struggle to continue happening and for people to continue grandstanding and making declarations and doubling down in alignment with whatever flavor of false information that they've chosen to support. I just apologize to the listeners for the crazy background noise on this particular podcast. We're just doing one track with one mic, and so we can't edit it out, and we're in the room with the dogs who are occasionally announcing themselves. I can tell you that the dogs are not gripped by mass hysteria. They're doing just fine. It's personality meets environment all the way down.
Yeah, I think actually it occurs to me that I just had an example come to mind of just how to, politics aside, just the extraordinary differences in personality about with respect to threat. Mm-hmm. And that is that I've got a friend of mine that is so conscientious and fastidious that she basically does not want to ever drive. Just doesn't want to drive. If she gets into a car, like, she knows in theory how to drive, but even backing out of the driveway, she's thinking about people that she could be hitting, even though she can look at the plain street behind her and see that there's nobody there. So this sounds to us like it's, quote, crazy, but it's not crazy. This is a normal, completely high-functioning, you know, reasonable-looking human that if you talked to her, you'd realize, wow, this person's pretty smart, pretty interesting, very productive, does excellent work for her boss, and yet super careful and worried about backing her car up out of a driveway. Contrast that with Mario Andretti's son, Michael, okay, who would speed through Pasadena and blow away the little old lady. In other words, no problem going doing 170 miles an hour down an open street. So these are the vast disparities of risk tolerance depending upon, you know, domain. So the Corona situation is absolutely, as Jen has said, which I stole the other day, by the way, on AJ's thing, I called it the big Rorschach test. Which I stole from you. But that's what it is. As Jen said, this is a beautiful Rorschach test, which is now completely, you know, essentially entwined in also political issues. One of the things that I think is a little bit ironic is that just to give people a little step back with the political implications of this, is that just ironically, because we happen to have the president that we do and we have the situation that we do, it turns out that the right is now all about, hey, let's let everybody do what they want, mm-hmm. Okay? Which is, of course, exactly what they don't feel about when it comes to terminating pregnancies,
right,
or a whole bunch of other things.
Physical sovereignty,
right,
over your body.
Of course. Mm-hmm. So in other words, there's no principle involved here.
Yeah.
This just happens to be who's siding on what side of the problem. So if you happen to be on the left, you're all about, let's put our masks on and everybody be responsible. Now, ironically, if we hop across the pond, we see Sweden, who is notoriously socialistic, mm-hmm. and have a very peaceful kind of a socialistic-ish society. They're not socialists, but they're a European socialist is what they are, which is a model for our political left, when our political left talks about socialism, they're not talking about the socialism of the USSR. They're talking about Northern European left-wingedness. It's highly respected and valued in our political left, and that's where they think America ought to be. Except they wouldn't want America right now to be doing what the Swedes are doing. That would be a terrible political, crime, etc. So we're seeing that the views here that are coming out, the fact that they're highly politically tinged and charged, makes no sense with respect to the facts that are on the table. These are arbitrary, and it has to do with particular political issues. The truth of the matter is, as we find in most things, is we have uncertainty sitting in the middle of a mess. So it appears that the mess is not nearly as bad as everybody feared, but the mess is now looking like it's a bit worse than the best case scenario was looking 2 or 3 weeks ago. But one thing that I have a lot of people that talk to me about wanting me to do an update tonight, but I'm not going to do it. But I do want to point something out that remains almost completely undiscussed in the media, and that is that the vast majority of victims everywhere are over 70 years old. And most of them, the most likely case would be that you would be over 85. The next most likely case would be that you would be between 75 and 85. People that are 75 to 95 are the majority of the victims in the United States, not by percentage, by raw numbers. People under 65 are a very small percentage of this issue, and if you're under 55, your odds are extremely low of being a victim of corona. So, I mean, you may be a victim and be laid up for 2 weeks, but you're not going to be a fatality. So this is a country that because of the political issues and the uncertainties that remains on high alert with an awful lot of charged feelings about this. And what we're going to find at the end of the day is the truth is in the muddy middle, and it's in a place where that perspective isn't getting a lot of reporting.
Wonderful. So yeah, maybe hopefully in a future show we can kind of get an update. Maybe in an upcoming show we get an update and answer some of the other questions that have come in about some of the stats as well, Dr. Lyle.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, by the way, one thing that irritates the daylights out of me is when I boot up and I try to learn about where Sweden's at, and I see all kinds of big headlines about how terrible it is in Sweden and how it's all falling apart and how it was a terrible mistake. There is nothing of the kind like that going on in Sweden. Sweden is doing very well in this epidemic. And incidentally, the head guy in charge had a beautiful interview that I read here in the last 2 days. He said, I mean, talk about a non-politician. He said, "I'm not sure we did the right thing." What a mensch. In other words, he's saying, hey, if it turns out that the evidence shows that we're making a mistake, then we'll change course. We have to be open to the fact that there may be new information. We can't possibly do that any other way. The reason why we did it the way we did it is because based on the information I had at the time, I believed that this would be the best course of action. And quite frankly, the data is supporting him very well. But I love the fact that he has the humility as a scientist and a public servant to actually recognize that he might be wrong, and it is never too late to put the genie back in the bottle. You can always go at any point at whatever expense and change direction if you need to. And so this is a remarkable country doing a remarkable thing behind a remarkable man. So, hey, we'll see. We'll all learn from it.
That is not a display that you're going to see in American politics. You're not going to see it. I mean, the left would be very quick to say, well, that Trump would never admit if
we
he was
hope,
wrong about something. But neither would Gavin Newsom.
Yeah.
Like, nobody in American politics, American politicians are not rewarded for intellectual honesty and humility. It is not, this is sort of a bonus of parliamentary democracy that we don't have here. So, yeah, we're going to push each other to extremes, and we're going to double down, even if it means hoping for the worst case scenario.
All right, Nathan, let's see what else we got.
All right, we got one more question, and this is a topic that it seems to be a very interesting topic for a lot of listeners, and Dr. Hawk wound out on it last week. So, hi there, doctors. We're very interested to hear about some of the theory around self-esteem. It resonated very strongly with me in the current situation, as I definitely struggle without meaningful work. I was wondering if you would be able to develop on this and perhaps the role of status in an anxious mind.
Well, there's I'm not sure that everything in that comment is necessarily clearly related. I think I see the relationships. The theory of self-esteem that, I don't know, one of these days, I don't ever want to change the way I've got things defined, and you and I'll be talking this over as we write our book. But the term people use self-esteem, they confuse it with what is the phenomenon of self-confidence. And self-confidence and self-esteem are, in my judgment, they are interrelated, but they are completely different. They are very different things. Self-esteem is the internal audience's judgment of your effort. Self-esteem is effectively it's an internal moral code, is what it is. The self-confidence is your perceived probability of success with respect to some endeavor, you know, worth seeking.
I used the example last week on the podcast of preparing your house for a big party, and you and I had talked about that at some point. So you've got self-confidence if you're having a big party that your house is clean and everybody's coming over and it'll be fine, but you've shoved everything in the closet and under the bed and your internal audience is very upset with you. Whereas if you had spent the day doing very careful work and cleaning things up, even if your house is not yet quite presentable, your self-esteem is very high, even if your self-confidence that the house is presentable is not that high.
Right.
Yeah.
There you go. Great. So that's a great analogy.
It's a way that people can keep it straight.
Yes. So let me get back to the person thinking that the lockdown. So the lockdown, maybe what they're saying is that they're struggling without meaningful work, which means that they're not the self-esteem issue. It's more complicated because you've actually got three different important feeling dynamics that are involved in human action. One of them is self-esteem, in other words, the internal monitor of your own moral code. Second is your self-confidence, which is your perceived probability of success in a display. And third is the feeling of getting esteem from other people, which is actually the loudest, most important feeling that goes off inside of human beings. In other words, so if you're not working, you're not getting esteem signals, feedback from other people. If you're not actually trying to do anything productive at all with your life, your self-esteem mechanism is tapping its foot, rolling its eyes, and is feeling disgusted with you. Okay? Your self-confidence mechanism is only relevant with respect to whatever targets that you're pursuing as goals. So so what I would say is, if you don't have anything to do and you are feeling the lack of esteem in your life because you're not getting any productive interplay between other individuals signaling to you that you're valuable, then one of the things that you can do and should do is work diligently at the deep cleaning of your life, whatever that is. Get in shape. Clean out the garage. You know what I'm saying? Get rid of a bunch of extra clothes that you don't need. Organize your taxes. There's plenty to do. Most people's lives are behind. One of the reasons they're behind is because there never seems to be a correct CB for establishing deep order. A lot of times a business just gets into business. If you're just opening a taco stand and you sort of know what you're doing, pretty soon you just do things willy-nilly that seem to work well enough. And 14 years later, you're still doing it that way. And it's not as efficient as it could be because it turns out it was never really thought that well through at the beginning. So things weren't organized that well. If you don't have any tacos to sell right now, and so you aren't getting esteem signals from the world for your productive activity, what you can do is you can organize your whole taco stand so that when you reopen, that your life is better and more efficient and more effective. So I have many people that continue to call us, trying to get their act together with respect to food, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this is a perfect time. For example, one of the most important things that you can do is actually organize your kitchen, pantry, freezer, menu lists, et cetera, so that you can have a continuous stream of healthy food that is organized. You go get your Tupperware containers organized, get little labels. Essentially, if you have struggled with this, this is a perfect time to establish outstanding order in an area of your life that has been sort of chaotic and inefficient. It could be in other areas as well. It could be a time for you to take a little visit to Fasting Escape. Hey, how about that, Nathan? Put that in there.
Staying six feet away from Nathan at all times, of course. Right.
Yeah, Fasting Escape, where we make fasting a little less miserable.
There you go. There you go.
It's a winning slogan.
There you go. That's a great slogan. So anyway, yeah, this is a perfectly good time to there'd be no reason for your self-esteem to do anything other than be strengthened and enhanced in a situation like this. If you are without, quote, things to do and demands from the world, hunker down and do things that your internal audience is aware will be effective and useful for you long term.
Even though that this is the time when your whole psychology is stacked against you and telling you that the next best thing to do for your genetic survival is anything other than clean up your taco stand. It's to go eat the tacos. It's to go like avoid competition. And we talked about this last week as well. So this whole thing only works if you really recognize at a deep level the innate rewards of tapping into the self-esteem mechanism, which is a very subtle process. And it's very, unless you've kind of lived there a little bit, it's hard to remember that it really is its own reward to get the attaboys from the internal audience. But that is something that you just kind of have to trust us when we tell you that that's a worthwhile emotion to experience. And then you have to find out for yourself that that is true.
Yes.
And you have nothing to lose. I mean, what do you have to lose? A couple hours in a clean closet, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about all this is that what's pushing against you is energy conservation.
Right.
And so there's, if you realize that you've just been handed a massive excuse as to why it is that you just get to stay inside and do not much of anything, and essentially that you and the rest of the world has been given a free pass. This is this person may be feeling some anxiety. And essentially feeling some low-grade tension that they're not doing enough productive activity and they're leaving some risk factors on the table. This is a perfectly good time to actually do the deep clean, watch your self-esteem respond to it for its own sake, and put yourself in a better position to essentially lead a better life at the other end. Now, this is only going to go on for so long, folks, whether it's a few weeks or a few months. This entire fiasco that we are dealing with here is going to be over. And when it's over, life is going to return very much to this normal that it did before. So anybody that's dreaming about that things are going to be dramatically different a year from now is completely off base. This is going to return to a great deal of normalcy. And when it does, we want to be just that much better prepared for the new season.
Absolutely wonderful. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for answering these questions. I feel like you just described my situation. Last week I talked about why I started cleaning my garage and some of the things that I was behind in. You know, you're completely right. It's just that those feelings just came back. I mean, within 6 days, you know what I mean? It was just mm-hmm. wonderful. So
beautiful.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to both of you guys in the next show.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Have a good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.